Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Ammo Art Chat. These particular shows, are basically going to be centered around the Representational Art Conference, which takes place in Ventura, California, from March 2nd to the 5th in 2014. And this particular show is going to be focusing on why beauty matters to representational art. And with me through these series of interviews that we'll be doing as my co-host is Michael Pierce, and I'd like to say hello to Michael.
Well, hello, Linda. It's lovely to be back with you today.
Yes, it's a beautiful day here in Ohio, and I'm sure it's always beautiful in California, especially in March. So people
yeah,
will definitely
well,
have
it's
to be
been, it's been a bit cooler way. This year, but pretty fantastic, though, yeah. California is always wonderful.
Yeah, I'm actually looking very forward to being out in California in March, because in Ohio it's very gray and cloudy and snowy and all that good cold stuff. So the beaches sound particularly well. Yes, yes. So
you'll love it. You know, the conference is on the beach. You see the surfers out there catching the waves. It's fantastic. You're going to love it.
Yep. I am. I'm really looking forward to it. So, and as we talked earlier, we're going to be talking about why beauty matters to representational art. And I believe our guest, who I'm going to allow you to introduce, is very up to date on why beauty matters as far as Roger Scruton is concerned. And he's kind of studies Roger. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, I think you're right in saying that. Mike and I have had many conversations about Roger Scruton and about beauty, of course. We're good friends, and it's, I must admit, slightly odd to be talking with Mike on the radio with you, because we spend a lot of time together in person, you know, in the studios, and looking at stuff that we're making and painting and talking about art and eating and drinking together, of course. So it's a bit of a different experience to be introducing him on the radio. Mike is a wonderful painter. He specializes in painting still lives, particularly, which I think are just gorgeous. Actually, I'm writing about one of them right now for Combustus. I'll tell you about it later on. And it's a real treat to have one of his paintings sitting in front of me on a daily basis to enjoy and appreciate. Mike Adams, are you there with us on the other line?
Yes, I am.
Excellent.
Yeah,
how lovely to have you here with us.
Welcome. I'm ready to pour a drink. Yes, is it gin and tonic time, Michael? So, yes, thank you so much, Linda, and thank you, Michael. Thank
well,
you.
You're welcome.
It's
well,
great
good
to, be here.
To have you here.
Yeah very honored to have you with
Linda.
Us, Michael. Okay, well, in preparing for the show, I basically watched Roger Scruton's Why Beauty Matters. I was able to actually find it on the web. It was not available on the web for a long time, so was very happy to have seen that. And basically, in the first few minutes of Roger's film, Why Beauty Matters, he talks about asking any educated person from 1750 to the 1930s to describe the aim of art, poetry, or music, and they would reply, beauty. And he also states that beauty is a value as important as truth or goodness. He goes on to say that beauty in the 20th century was not important, that originality was important. So is that suggesting that a work of art can be original but not beautiful, or can be beautiful but not original, or is it not even an either-or?
You know, I think that it can be original and not beautiful, or beautiful and not original. I think that what Roger is pointing out is that the beauty is just no longer an issue at all in most postmodern art. It's been discarded or discredited completely. I was just watching a BBC special this morning, actually, about modern art and postmodern art, and how some artists are creating works that initially look beautiful, but then put like elephant dung on them just to make sure that they don't hold that beauty any longer. So it challenges beauty directly. So it's really interesting what's happened. What I see that doing, of course, is denying one of the most basic things, experiences of the human experience, is that enjoyment of beauty, of beautiful things. And I think of beauty as an experience more than something that an object possesses. It's how we experience an object or another person or a landscape or just beautiful light coming through a window. So that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about Chris Ofili's painting that you're referring to, Mike, and the sort of somersaults that people get into in trying to justify using the elephant poo that he put underneath the painting, and to justify his use of pornography as well. And it's all about this sort of endless conceptual justification for making things that reinforce a rather negative outlook, in my view. I think the originality part, actually, there isn't that much originality. They're reusing materials a lot of the time and putting stuff into the gallery. They don't make it themselves a lot of the time. They're just putting a toilet in there or whatever. So it's really not about the originality as much as it's about the idea that drives the motivation of the artist to put that thing in the gallery. So it's about concept and about the transference of an idea. And I think there's a lot of truth to that part of postmodernity. And when you read Duchamp about his putting the toilet in the gallery, you find this, you know, he really is concerned with consciousness. He's not concerned with art, and repeatedly denies art and says he doesn't want art to exist anymore. He dislikes the concept of art, the idea of art, in the form that he found it in the end of the 19th century, in the very early days of the 20th century. So I think there's a lot to conceptual art that matters to us, of course, but the way that it's expressed in ready-mades and in much contemporary work, I just think it emphasizes a negative consciousness, not a positive consciousness. And beauty, of course, I think, would carry us up and towards something better than ourselves when we experience beauty. So that consciousness is a quite different thing to emphasize. Originality, I'm not so sure I agree with Roger about this, that originality isn't actually necessarily uniquely connected to beauty. I think some conceptual art can be very original, but and also some figurative art can be very unoriginal, but rather beautiful. So I don't quite agree with Roger about this, and I'm looking forward to talking to him about it and finding out more about what he says when he comes to California in March.
Yeah, and I think that throughout the special, I think that he's being deliberately provocative in some of his statements. So I think that kind of a phrase where he's throwing out creativity or originality is becoming the important thing. And beauty is thrown out. I think that's overstating the fact. I mean, in 20th century art, not just representational art, but other forms of art, is actually quite beautiful.
Right.
Even if it is not representational, I don't think beauty disappeared, but it's certainly. I think he's right when saying that in many cases, he may say in all cases, but in many cases, art or beauty becomes a byproduct of the artwork rather than a central focus. And I think that that's absolutely true. Now, there are some artists who have been working who the central focus is the beautiful object. Matisse was one of those people who his central focus was beauty. That was what his artwork was about. And there's more other contemporary art. I don't know if Mark Rothko would have said that beauty was central to his artwork, but I find his work very beautiful. It's not objective, but to me, it's a beautiful, beautiful statement and visual statement. So, beauty is again, I think beauty is an experience. It's also subjective, and it's also very personal as well. So, yeah, I think
I get anxious when I start hearing people talking about beauty being subjective, though. That worries me a bit, because I think beauty is something we can, if not point at, but we can know where it lives. Beauty is difficult to define, but that doesn't mean that it's not real. And a postmodern view would take what we just said, that it's subjective, and say, well, that means it's not real. Do you see where I'm going with that? And I think that's not quite right. I think beauty is a category. I'm calling it a cloud category. It's got soft edges. There are places where things definitely are not beautiful, but also there are things that are beginning to be beautiful and aren't quite there yet.
Sure, I always like the term. I forgot his name. A gentleman who just died recently, the art critic, died recently. But he was called it the shock of the new. Occasionally, there are things that are new, they're unique, and we don't know quite what to make of them, but we know we react to them in a very positive way. And ultimately, they become beautiful in our experience, which is an interesting thing that happens with art. Music especially does that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've been looking at your still life for 3 weeks now, I guess. Linda, and everyone listening, the project I'm working on with Mike is to spend time every morning. When I get up in the morning, I sit and write, and I spend time every morning looking at Mike's still life painting. It's a small still life of a rather beautiful half-peeled orange. And I've been looking at the painting now for 3 weeks, and I'm at the point now where I've thought through it and considered all these different angles and different ways into it, and the kind of the hidden messages of it, the aesthetics of it, the paint, the proportion, the color, the technique, all that. And now it's presenting itself to me just as a thing. And I'm very comfortable with it, and it's a very different experience. Now I've assimilated the thinking behind the piece, which is a fairly simple painting of a half-peeled orange, as I said. You would think there's not that much to pull out of a half-peeled orange painting, but actually there is. But now I've assimilated those thoughts. Now I'm looking back, and the painting is reflected in my eyes. When I look at it, I'm no longer looking at it and seeking out the thinking behind it, because it's within me. So now when I look at the painting, it provides me with comfort and reaffirmation of what I think, because I'm in agreement with the ideas that are in the painting. And I think that that's got a lot to do with beauty, this sense of affirmation and an evolution of consciousness that we experience when we look at a beautiful piece of art. Thanks for that, Mike.
Oh, you're welcome. But the interesting thing for me, when I hear you say that, and this goes back to much of what we talk about in art in general, is that you don't know what my intentions were. Linda, I actually created this piece of art specifically for Michael to use. I delivered it. It was still wet. And I had a certain intention there. I have a certain meaning in that artwork, which I have not shared with Michael, and Michael doesn't know what that is. So whatever he is pulling out of that is coming from him,
right?
And somehow coming from the painting. So that's the magic of art to me. And that's really where the artwork is completed in itself too, is in that interchange between the exchange of concept and idea from the work to the audience. And I'm really interested to see what you have to say about it, Michael. And then I'll share with you what it means to me. By the way,
good idea. I'll have to interview you. I'll interview with what you intended by it, and we'll see how closely they correspond.
Thing also is that I created this composition and the objects in there I knew that they had meaning to me, and this happens to me often, and I think this happens to, again, artists all the time. You create something, and you know that there's meaning, but you don't really know what it is. It's kind of a psychological issue. And you discover that after the fact, after it exists. I went over to Michael's house, and I saw it, and I realized what this painting was about. Only then, which is really interesting for me. So anyhow, that has a lot to do with intention, but it also has something about, and going back to beauty and representational art and beauty, I hope that what I've done with that painting, and I know this is what happens when I see other representational art works that are of great beauty, that this draws you in. It becomes an intimate relationship almost immediately. So.
But yes, and it's not back, so much a... Oh, go ahead, Linda. I'm sorry, I stepped on you.
That's right. I was going to actually step back a little bit from what you guys were talking about. When you were talking about beauty, and Michael, you were saying that you get really uncomfortable with it being thought of as in a subjective way, and when I was listening to you talk about that, I'm wondering if people are confusing recognizing beauty in a painting and the feelings that come from that with an actual transcendence. That, to me, they're two different things. I can look at a number of beautiful paintings, but I'm not transcendent by every one of them. And then,
indeed,
you know,
there's an aesthetic experience of the beautiful thing, and then there's the emergent experience of the beautiful thing. They are indeed two totally different things. One of them is a consciousness affirmation in which you lose yourself in the experience of looking at the beautiful thing, right? And we've all had this experience. You're lost in that moment. And then the other is to look at a thing which you know rationally is beautiful, but it doesn't have that effect on you. You can appreciate it, and you can analyze it and take it apart in your mind and recognize the elements of it that that leads towards it being beautiful, the skill that's been used in putting it together, the craftsmanship, and all these other aspects that that go that way, but doesn't necessarily provide the experience. So, yes, I do agree. I think there are absolutely two totally separate phenomena going on in that one word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you,
Michael.
I think that Michael's exactly right. There are those two experiences. The visual arts, especially in painting, I think it was just a few paintings that just really have affected me quite deeply, and I have that transcendent experience. My list is relatively short, actually, and it won't be the same as Michael's, although one of them might just be. Breezing Up is one. Winslow Homer is...
Oh, yes.
Up.
One of my favorite painters from when I was a child, Mike. That one.
Yeah.
I just love that painting because you can feel the wind in the painting. When I was 14 or 15 and I first saw it, it was like I was at sea. I just couldn't believe that someone could make something like that. Just sensational.
Yeah. Yeah. So that sort of experience that just takes you to another place. Oh, amazing. But then, as you said, you go through some exhibits, some very, very nicely crafted artwork, and you can rent the headphones from the museum and learn all about why you should be transcended, have a transcended experience, but you just don't. I mean, you appreciate the craft, and those of us who are educated and have the aesthetic elements and principles, you understand how it was created and appreciate it for that. But for whatever reason, it doesn't really quite move us to that other level. And that's a mystery, and I love that for the mystery of it.
I'm not so sure it is entirely a mystery, though, Mike. I think it has a lot to do with your state of mind and your consciousness. If consciousness is evolutionary, which I think it is, you gradually acquire knowledge as you get older, and your consciousness shifts from one period of your life to another. You know, we're not the same person entirely as we were when we were young. Our consciousness has shifted and changed as we've grown and learned. So I think that when we meet a work of art, that work of art speaks to our consciousness, because that's what art is, after all. It's a statement made in material by an artist who's applying his consciousness to the movement of materiality. So when we look at a work of art, we're deliberately appreciating a statement of consciousness from the artist, which has been made for one reason or another. So sometimes when we look at even a really fabulous work of art, that consciousness doesn't meet us. It's not mirrored in us. We don't recognize ourselves in it. My favorite example is talking about visiting the Lippi Madonna over in the Uffizi in Florence, and having this moment of almost a revelation or epiphany, standing in front of that painting that is so beautiful and so finely crafted, and that anyone could make that was just astounding to me. Mm-hmm. Quality in it. But within that experience, that now has changed. So now I'm looking at the painting in a very different light, because I've assimilated that into myself, and now I appreciate the painting for other terms. My memory of that experience carries me to still appreciate it as an extraordinarily beautiful thing, but I'm not having that same experience every time I look at it, right?
Yeah.
So the experience changes and shifts, even with paintings that do give us that emergent moment. And that's because our consciousness changes and evolves along the way. And I think that explains why much art doesn't have that same impact. It takes particular circumstances for us to find and meet the work of art that mirrors itself in our consciousness and allows us to emerge and elevate consciousness to a new level or a different level.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we as individuals need to prepare ourselves for that experience, or do you think that we can, because sometimes that experience is such a surprise to me. But one of the great places that I love actually witnessing people have this beauty experience, this experience of beauty, is a very magical and crystalline interior of Saint Chapelle in Paris. It's an amazing church. It's one of the few Gothic churches that is still painted in the deep blues and gold leaf and glass walls that go soaring. You enter it by going up a small staircase, and if you sit or stand in the sanctuary with all this glass, and as people come through the door, especially if it's their first time visiting this place, you hear gasps as dust, truly their breath is taken going into that space. And you can tell it's a surprise, but they've kind of anticipated something. I know that. So I don't know. Yeah. So it's really interesting to see that experience and experience yourself. So when you met Lippi's painting, I don't know if you had an anticipation for what to expect, or you just came across that.
No, it took me by surprise. I didn't even know the painting before I saw it, actually. And, I think a lot of it had to do with that I want to paint like that. For me personally, I can imagine if other people who aren't artists see art, I'm sure that their reactions are based on entirely different things.
Yeah, and you're probably like me. We trip the alarm when we go too close to it.
Always. Oh, good.
to try to figure out.
If you're not in trouble with security guards, you're not looking.
I've been shooed away way too often as well. I'm not going to touch it. I'm just looking.
But, this leads me to think of other people's experiences and how we make art to give to other people. Artists make things that they want to share, and that makes me think that there's a bit of a responsibility that goes with it, not just making art, but also in the art that we choose to look at and choose to spend time with. Because it seems to me, here's a crunchy problem for you: is beauty moral in any way? Is beauty good or bad? Plato would say that beauty always tended to goodness, but I can look at art that has been made using the tools of beauty but to express really horrible, nasty ideas. And I can point them to you on the internet. I don't particularly want to because I don't like the ideas, but they're out there. But those paintings are made beautifully, and you can recognize beauty in them, in the aesthetic sense. Now, if you allow yourself to be open to paintings that are deliberately mean or nasty, then what does that do for your evolving consciousness? And doesn't that mean that we have a responsibility when we make art?
Yeah, do all artists have that responsibility? I don't know. I think being conscious of what the effect may have is important. I know that we've talked before about kind of the fall of representational art happened because representational art was associated so strongly with the propaganda type art that was being used in Nazi Germany, and that association really destroyed a lot of the ideas or using representational art as a way to express an idea. It's just too strongly related to that, and I think that those people who try, I think you have to be really careful if you're going to try to create a moral message. Trying to change people's minds to think in a more moral, at a higher level or moral plane. I think you run the risk, unless you're an extraordinary artist, I think. You really run a risk of bordering on being either preachy or...
Definitely, yeah. Didactic, you bet.
Yeah,
and propagandistic.
So I think you have I think it's a slippery slope there. There are some people who are suited for that. On the other hand, I think... I was just reading Jed Pearl's essay on Chardin. What a wonderful essay it is, but he's talking about a really wonderful artist who takes the most ordinary-looking objects and raises them up to something that really is transcendent. And in a way that kind of creates, it gives us a sense of the world as something that is better than our ordinary experience, even in the ordinary things. To me, that is elevating to a higher moral and spiritual plane through simple objects and through simple and kind of quiet moments. To me, that is. So it doesn't have to be something we bludgeon people with. You know, get them over the head. This is going to make you better. You know, this is good for you. Or you can invite them to look at the world as a great place to live. This is a wonderful gift that we have of life, and let's celebrate it and see that there is something great about, and life is worthwhile. That I think is, I'm not sure if it's a responsibility of all artists, but I would hope that more artists will take that tact. I mean, I do understand the idea of criticizing social wrongs, political misdoings, I understand that, and I understand creating paintings of moral outrage. I think that we're all tempted to do so, but I think it's that one's a tightrope that you're walking as an artist, especially one that if you're out in public eye pretty strongly. I don't know. That's an issue. That's a difficult one for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, I was sitting here thinking about what the two of you are saying, and I'm probably the lesser experience. I'm sure you and Michael have much more experience as an artist, as in years of painting, than I do. And, you know, I'm at the point where I'm painting something, and maybe I haven't figured out why it is I want to paint that particular painting, and it feels like I'm creating something beautiful, but I don't have a concept behind it. And I think there's a time in everyone's career when they start moving away from that technical work of making sure that the painting is technically correct to wanting to start bringing in something to say with their work. And I teach a lot of hobbyists or amateur artists or just beginning artists, however you want to say that. And, you know, they're more concerned with not what the piece is saying, but is it technically correct? So I think there is definitely like a growth that an artist goes through, that you start talking about, you know, do I have something moral to say, or do I try to raise awareness on something? That's just my opinion. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but thinking back at your starting life.
Well, I know that both Michael and I teach beginning painting and drawing. And, yeah, I think that we, as teachers, especially at that level, you're trying to give people a vocabulary. You're giving them the tools to, in order to express it. It's very similar to teaching a writing class. You want to
right.
teach them how grammar and structure and all the tools that they need in order to express themselves in words. You're doing it for expressing themselves in visual form, so they can express themselves effectively. So when they do have those concepts, if they feel like they need a concept to express, or they just have a visual experience. Obviously, this is a visual language. So if they have a visual experience that they want to share with the world, Michael calls, as Michael has been terming it, their consciousness of this experience that they're having, they need those tools in order to do it
mm-hmm.
well. I mean, that's really what the Representational Art Conference and kind of skill-based, advocating skill-based learning and instruction, that's what that's all about, is the idea of elevating our ability to express ourselves more clearly and more effectively. Now, whether or not, I do know that I've been painting for a long time, but I haven't been in the professional realm for that long. It's only been maybe 4 or 5 years. But being around a lot of other professional artists who talk about high concept, it becomes, I feel a pressure that I need to be saying something significant, I'm putting that in quotes, significant, in order to legitimize my work. And I'm now kind of coming around to reconciling that, you know, just celebrating that life is worthwhile is significant enough for me. And I think that's a significant, important idea that postmodernism has been telling us otherwise. Postmodernism is telling us life sucks, deal with it, or complain about it. And I feel like life doesn't suck. I think that there are some really, really tragic things that happen in life, and there's some real hard times. We've gone through a lot of death in our family recently, in recent years, but that just makes me feel like life is even more valuable and more precious and more worthwhile, something to celebrate. So to show these little bits of life, not the grand statements, but the little bits, is fine. So if one of your artist students chooses to take up flower painting, just make sure that they're doing it well, you know, express it and really create the thing that they really want to do. And I think that's significant enough. You may have, like Herman Melville had Moby Dick inside of him, so he needed to write that book. But not all artists have a Moby Dick inside them. You know, some are like Chardin, who had crockery and an egg to tell us that life is worthwhile. So that's my lecture for the day.
I think you put it really beautifully, Mike. It's that was beautifully put. I just want to note, though, that you thought yourself to that point.
It's true.
You know why you're doing it, and that's really, really important, is to know why, to have that context for your work is super important. And thank you for telling us that. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I think that that journey is the one that I think is really important for all artists to take. And what that does is challenges, we sometimes use the word authenticity, and I think that's really where the moral plane is reached, that higher moral plane is reached, when you can be truthful to yourself and know that what you have to express is legitimate because it's yours, and it's uniquely yours, but you share humanity with others, the human experience with others. So you can tell others that this is something that you, this is my unique experience of the world. I want to share it with you. But you do it from your point of view. You know it's your own, and it's not what somebody else is telling you you need to be doing. And I think that's really important. But it's hard to discover that. It's really hard to discover that. And it may be just a matter of discovery throughout your life. I don't know. I mean, I'm every time I sit, it's really funny. Every time I sit in front of an easel, I shouldn't be, but I'm always nervous. Always nervous. I don't feel quite worthwhile or worth. Yeah, I don't think that I'm up to the challenge of being honest with myself sometimes. So yeah, it's a struggle for me. But
that makes me sad.
No. To me, that's part of it. It's part of the process.
Is it internal wrestling or? Okay.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
But that's not all of your experience, Mike. You know, we've talked in the past about how you get lost in making the paintings. You're talking about a moment at the
beginning
of making
the painting. That's what I'm talking about when I beginning of making the painting. Yes.
Yeah.
Once I start getting into it, then it's good. It's good.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I've seen your work.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to leave it out there as if I was struggling and moping and groaning throughout the whole thing. No, I'm doing fine. About an hour or two in, I do pour myself a glass of wine, though. I do. I'll admit. That helps.
I think we all have our little things that we do that gets us closer to that zen moment or that time where it's just kind of flowing through us. So.
Yeah, that little ritual.
And if it doesn't come right away, it does get, it does, you know, if that doesn't come right away, or if we're forcing it, you know, it does start to get a little scary.
Yeah. Anyhow, we kind of off point, I suppose.
So I think it's all part of it. Process is all part of making beauty, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah.
Michael,
there's a lot of different. I was just going to say, I think there's a lot of reasons for painting, aren't there? You know, and is beauty one of the big reasons for motivating painting? We've talked a little bit about that, but I guess for some people it's purely about beauty, and for some people we get too stuck on selling stuff. You know, we're painting for the market, right?
Yeah, I think that's a real interesting challenge now, is the whole dealing with the marketplace. I know that there's a lot of artists now, especially in the representational world, who rightfully feel as though they have been kind of relegated to the sidelines in the marketplace. And they're really struggling with finding meaning in their art to somehow break into the legitimate world, or they may be really fighting the revolution to get there. That one also is a hard one. When we start talking about the marketplace and trying to paint or create artwork for the marketplace, as professionals, that's the definition of professional, is that you're actually doing something to sell it. You're not a hobbyist. This is how you make your living. So sales are important. The question is whether you need to sell to the world or do you need to sell to a niche of the marketplace that responds to your work? And at what level do we settle for acceptance as representational artists? Do we have an opportunity? I guess sometimes we get the sense, and I think it's a reality actually, that representational art is becoming more of a player in the broader and higher art level art market. I'm not sure if that's really true, but that's my sense. I sure hope it is, because that's the kind of work I do. The marketplace is a sticky area, because you also, in order to remain authentic, you really have to be careful not to paint specifically for the market, or just those things that you know sold last week or last month or last year. You start repeating yourself in order to kind of redo that rather than grow and stay authentic to your initial vision and what you're trying to express through your art. So it's a
delicate
and again,
balance.
You still need, yeah, you, then again, you also need to put food on the table. So it's a tough one to work through. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Michael. I don't know if we've ever talked about that as far as representational art. Really, what would be? I don't know if we actually are envisioning what the world will be in the future or where we hope it will be. I know we're tremendous advocates for representational art and skill-based training.
Yeah.
I suspect it
isn't going to be there's not going to be a sort of revolution in representational art rules the world or anything like that.
Yeah.
There's going to be a much more of a pluralistic society but one in which representational art has its place at the table, which has been lacking distinctly for the last 30 or 40 years. Now that's turning around. There are quite a lot of really fantastic artists who are working away out there making extraordinary art. I do think representational art is gaining its place at the table now. I'm not so sure that we're going to see a gigantic pendulum swing. After all, computers are here to stay, television is here to stay, and all these aspects of consumer culture and the great spectacle that Guy Debord described, they're all here. We are living in the society of the spectacle. We are living in a pluralistic society in which there's room for all kinds of different approaches to life. But I think within that, the representational art world is going to become an increasingly strong player just because of the democratic appeal of it. People understand representational art. They love it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very clearly the art of the people.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. Yeah, I think that, and I'm really comfortable with a pluralistic society rather than, because frankly, I do like some of the, the entertainment value of some of the postmodern work. I don't necessarily think it's high art, some of it.
Right, but it's amusing.
It's entertaining.
For a while, right?
Yeah, so.
It's like going to Disneyland.
So, exactly.
Disneyland, if you think about it, Disneyland is a huge installation art project. When you go to Disneyland, you're fully embraced in the imagination of that corporate mind. You know, you've joined into that consciousness by being immersed in the world of Disneyland. It's a pure art installation. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The lengths they go to make it the total spectacle, which is, by the way, an outcropping of Antonin Artaud, who was a theoretician in the theater. He predicted things like Disneyland back in the 1940s, I think it was, and rather remarkably described something that really resembled Disneyland in his book about the theater. It's a fairly old idea that's been thoroughly exploited to create a world which is fully engaged in the imagination of the creator. So you have food at Disneyland that's created in the Disney style, and even the people who visit Disneyland wear Disney ears and Disney costumes and Disney stuff, right? And giant foam hands. You're all participating in the great spectacle. It's really quite extraordinary. And
it's
very entertaining and amusing. Everyone loves Disneyland. Of course, it's very popular. But it's definitely a work of art.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
I don't know if you're aware, Michael and Mike, of an artist that lives out in L.A. He's a Chinese artist, Davey Liu, I think is how you pronounce it. He's an artist. He takes painting trips, workshops, people over to China to paint, but he's also creating an amusement park in China based on a series of books that he illustrated. So I was that struck me when you were talking about Disney, Michael, that this particular artist that lives out there in L.A. by you guys is doing almost the exact same thing in China from something that he basically created. So.
And when we talk about beauty, don't people experience things like Disneyland and like this gentleman's installation in China? Don't they experience beauty at some level?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. I think so.
And I think, again, that there's that challenge, you know, is beauty moral or you know, is it reserved for high art? I'm not sure it is. This is where it becomes cloudy and loose around the edges, you see.
Well, I think that obviously the marketplace, I mean, advertising has recognized the power of beauty, where, you know, this is something that, when you look at Scruton, of course, he's putting beauty at a much higher plane and probably kind of the misuse of beauty, and he would reject that advertising has anything beautiful in it, probably because of its intention to sell something in the consumers. But, you know, there's some really
I think that that's completely wrong. I really do.
Yeah.
I think when we look at ads in about 150 years' time, people will look back at the advertising of the 20th and 21st century, and they're going to look at it and say, oh, wow, that's gorgeous, because some of the advertising is beautiful. Without doubt, there are some really beautiful things. And what I'm interested in, though, is that if when we separate beauty, remember we talked earlier on about the two different categories of the word beauty. I think that the transcendent experience of beauty, when beauty is used in order to put forward an idea or a concept that could be associated with a product, then you get into that sticky area where you're inviting people to evolve their consciousness towards something which is manipulative and sometimes indecent and unpleasant and hostile to good living. So you know, I think that separation is really helpful to note that the idea that's being put forward by beauty might not necessarily be one that you want to expose yourself to.
Yeah, and to use beauty to manipulate, or to use the elements of beauty to manipulate, one of the things that Scruton talks about is beauty as being non-utilitarian. There is no utility for beauty. A true beauty is that which has no use. It's useless. I guess it's the wasn't Noel, not Noel Coward, but that as soon as we make a utility out of it, in other words, we're using images that elicit an emotional reaction. Sometimes we would call that an aesthetic reaction or a beauty experience. If we're using that in order to use it to sell you a product, then you're now taking that experience and corrupting it in the market as a tool for the marketplace, tool for consumerism. I would say, in that case, Roger Scruton would say that object no longer is beautiful because you've created something of a specific utility. Of course, if you're using artwork and beauty to raise people to a higher moral plane and spiritual plane, isn't that also trying to kind of sell a higher moral or spiritual plane? I mean, we're trying to persuade people to a different level.
Right, exactly right. That's my beef with Roger Scruton, actually, is that I think he misses the utility of beauty as an expression of consciousness, which it clearly is. You know, it's very difficult to get around Kant and Hegel and Peirce when they talk about consciousness understanding reality through senses only. I mean, that's it. That's all we've got. We can only perceive reality through our senses. And that means that, consequently, anything we make carries our consciousness into reality.
Yes.
So beautiful things that we make, the beautiful things that we make must carry consciousness with them. There's no way around. You can't escape it.
Yes. And that there's often a utility to that.
Yeah, indeed. And actually, Roger talks about it in his show. He visits Reading Town Center. I know Reading from growing up not far down the road, and it is truly a benighted rat hole of a city center. It's one of the worst city centers you could ever visit, closely followed by Swindon, I'm afraid, just down the road.
And, I think I'm going to get
you
letters
visit these,
from my UK fans.
Yes, I'm sorry, everyone in England. I apologize.
Beautiful people live there.
Well, the funny thing is that they're set in beautiful parts of England. That's the strange thing, is there's this disconnection between the city centres. I mean, if you go to Swindon and then you go to Wiltshire, you're in Stonehenge country and Avebury and beautiful villages all around Swindon. They're just gorgeous, absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain sort of contrast there between the utility of those city centres, which Roger points out in the show, and the beauty of the countryside around the city. It really is odd. And I think Roger points out that these city centres were constructed with utility in mind and absolutely no thought of beauty. And he's right. You know, you look at the photography of those cities now, and they really are quite dreary places. He points out that we didn't apply beauty to making them, and that makes them useless. That beauty is a necessity for making the utilitarian bearable.
Yeah, and for that I agree.
Right.
That I agree, yeah. But it is kind of interesting that without beauty, it's useless, but then you need beauty, which is useless into itself, to make the utilitarian useful. So, it is really kind of an interesting dichotomy there.
It does point to beauty being useful, doesn't it? Beauty is useful to make it bearable, to make a utilitarian thing worth having. You know, even when we make weapons, we make them beautiful. You look at the stealth fighters; they're just ridiculously beautiful airplanes, but they're designed to, you know, to kill people. So, about as utilitarian as it gets.
Yeah. And some of the really great art. I mean, we in Roger Scruton's BBC special, you know, he shows the David, Michelangelo's David. What a absolute miraculous piece of work. But it's also was used as propaganda for the Medicis. So
exactly
it was
right.
It was a useful sculpture. Now we forget that intention. We forget that was what the purpose of that sculpture was. Over the centuries, that has been lost. So we can experience the beauty of that sculpture from our own experience, not from the intention of its original use. And the Medicis were very, very smart people, very kind of like the Eli Broads of their time, the people who are elevating their status in the world by collecting art that attracts interest of their community. You know, the Broads collect work that I don't particularly see as being high art, but, you know, they may purchase a Jeff Koons sculpture that is entertaining, the stuff that you want to bring your kids to see, and then build a large facility and an established museum to display that in, and it elevates the value of their investment And it also provides something for the community. It's not my personal favorite kind of art to be trying to elevate the community's community relationship, but there is a purpose there, and you know, patrons have always done that. And art throughout the ages, except for just only, I suppose, the 20th century, has art really been used as just strictly a personal expression, I suppose. I have to look about my art history, but most of the time, art has been used as kind of as a tool for the patron.
I think so. The old word magnificence. Lorenzo the Magnificent wasn't called magnificent because he was, like a cathedral or something. He was called the Magnificent because he gave so much of noble character to the community. He made things so splendid for the people. That's what made him magnificent, was that he gave greatness to the community and the splendor to the surroundings that he was in. Magnificence. I wonder if we're going to come to a new period of magnificence. The 1%ers seem to have a gigantic amount of money sloshing around. I wonder if they'll start giving it back into the community by building great works of art and great buildings that are absolutely rich and gorgeous and display that magnificence that the Renaissance had.
Yeah, I think much to the dismay of a lot of the representational world, they tend to go to Art Basel for their purchases right at the moment. So looking at things that may not be what we consider to be high art, but that's where we get back to the marketplace. And interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting where we are. I think that there will be a patron, I believe that there will be a patron who has the courage or their convictions. I know that I think one of the things that we have now is you hear the phrase a lot, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. To me, I feel that's the saying that I need somebody to confirm my beliefs. We always want to have somebody, that's why we go on Facebook and Twitter, and hopefully people like what you have to say, or you think you really want to have this product, then you have to go online and get review after review after review to find out whether or not it's really, if your own judgment could be validated in some way. And I think that it takes some courage to have a belief in your own intuition. That patron who starts really looking at some of the representational art, and some of it is absolutely gorgeous, magnificent, strong work that's out there now. And as soon as the right patron sees that, starts collecting, and starts elevating it very much in the way they have been collectors for the postmodern world and modern art, it's going to happen again. But it's going to take somebody with a great deal of courage, because they have to do a lot of investing. Investors don't go just throwing the money at things that they don't feel there's going to be lasting value in. So it's going to be interesting to watch over the next couple of decades, I would think, to see a transition happen. I do believe that it is going to happen, though. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think you're right, Mike.
Yeah.
But all this is a good way to sum up, I think, the discussion. We are running low on time, Michael. Don't know if there's one last question you have for Mike.
Well, why don't we let's go around and say in a couple of sentences, why do you think beauty matters? In a couple of sentences.
I think beauty matters, because it really is an affirmation of our humanity. It's one of those experiences that we have, like love, passion, sorrow, grief. It's one of those emotions that we all have, one of those experiences that we all have, that we all share, and it's an affirmation of our humanity. And to deny it, and deny its place in art, is thus denying a part of who we are as humans. So I think beauty truly matters in that respect.
Yeah. How about you, Linda?
Well, I tend to try to think that beauty matters because it exists in all things. And when I say that, I mean, some people may want to tend to argue with me that beauty doesn't exist in ugly or bad things, but I think that is coming out of the way that you are using your opinions or judgments or upbringing, whatever, that molds you, that keeps you in that, you know, this is negative, therefore there can't be anything beautiful in something negative type of scenario. So I think it matters because I think it exists on all levels. And without beauty, I don't think that we would be still here. So kind of a different take on things, I guess.
And how about you, Michael?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's an absolute necessity to life. You know, if you want to live a full life and to be a whole person, if you like, then I think you really need to find things that are beautiful to surround yourself with. You know, we can do that whether we have money or not, whether we have a fabulous house to live in or not. It doesn't matter. We find beauty, as you say, in the everyday objects like Chardin. And finding beauty in our lives is an absolute necessity. We need beauty to make the utilitarian beautiful.
Okay. Well, Michael Lynn Adams, your website address is what, michaellynnadams.com?
michaellynnadams.com. And okay. My artwork, if you happen to be in South Carolina, Charleston, it's at the M Gallery in Charleston.
And great. Of course,
and,
please don't forget to visit the TRAC website, the Representational Art Conference, and that is at TRAC2014.org, TRAC2014.org. And then I beg your pardon, Linda?
I was just going to say, and registration is open, so they can register to join us in Ventura in March.
Yes, that's right. Yes, March 2nd through 5th is when the conference is. So do head out to Ventura and enjoy a few days beside the Pacific Ocean, watching the surfers and talking about great art and learning and observing some of our extraordinary demonstration artists. We've got some real treats in store, so do come and join us for that. The other quick plug I'd like to make is for Combustus magazine, where if you're interested in looking at the article that I'm writing about Mike's orange painting, that'll be on combustus.com. So do visit combustus.com. That's combustus.com.
And our next show that we will be airing will be with John Seed of the Huffington Post, and also Deanna Piawati of Combustus. And we will be talking about media in the 21st century and how its effects on representational art, what is its role, what kind of the responsibility of the media folks writing about art with those two fellows or those two people. And Michael, again, will be joining me as the co-host. So that will be airing in, I believe, November. So if you want to stay in touch with what is going on with AMMO Art Chat and when these episodes get aired and what schedules for coming up, there is a Facebook page called AMMO Art Chat. You can go there and like the page, and updates will be posted there. If you would like to receive a newsletter, you can go to artistmentorsonline.com and sign up for the newsletter, and we'll keep you up to date with who's guesting and what's next for us. So I wanted to, again, thank Michael Pierce and Michael Lynn Adams for joining us. This was a wonderful discussion on why beauty matters. Hope that you've enjoyed it. And, again, Michael and Michael, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity, Linda. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Oh, yes, it was a great time. I enjoyed it.
Always a good time on AMMO.
Oh, thank you. I have fun doing it, so... It's one of those labors of love. So, again, everybody have a good evening. Thank you for tuning in, and please share the episode with your friends so that they can find us and join in on the conversation that will be continuing at the Representational Art Conference. Thank you all. Good night.
Good night. Thanks, Mike.
Good night.